And welcome to the second film in our Oscar series here, breaking down the 10 Best Picture nominees for the 2025 Academy Awards. I am John Rocha, joined as always by my wonderful co-host, Steve Morris.
I'm trying to decide, should I use the acoustic guitar to accompany us or should I go electric? What's your feeling about this?
Baby, always go electric. Screw them. Always go electric. Hey, man, go electric. Anyway, so as you can probably guess, and probably because you read the title as well of this episode, we are going to be talking about a complete unknown, this Bob Dylan biopic focusing on his time, about 5 years of his time, 5-6 years of his time there in the early 1960s when he became a name and he led the folk. He was one of the leaders of the folk movement and then controversially went electric near the end of the 1960s. To cause division and problems there within the folk music scene. This one is directed by James Mangold. It is written by James Mangold and Jay Cox. It's based on Dylan Goes Electric, this book by Elijah Wald. And it stars Timothy Chalamet as Bob Dylan, Edward Norton as Pete Seeger, Elle Fanning as Sylvie Russo, Monica Barbaro as Joan Baez, Boyd Holbrook as Johnny Cash, Dan Fogler as Albert Grossman, Norbert Leo Butts as Alan Lomax and PJ Byrne as Harold Leventhal and Scoot McNairy as Woody Guthrie. And Steve, this one has been nominated for 8 awards as well. So your thoughts on A Complete Unknown?
You know, it's funny. We always talk about the difference, that there is some difference that's hard to define between what is the quote unquote best picture and what is your favorite movie of the year. So this, I don't know what I think the best picture of the year is. There's still a few nominees I haven't seen.
Yep.
I still have, of course, the Cinephiles award show coming up, which everyone can vote in if you just go to patreon.com/thecinephiles and join our free tier, which will allow you to join the Cinephiles Academy and vote just like you were at the Oscars for all of your favorites. And that's, like I said, is at patreon.com/thecinephiles. It's absolutely free, and we will be revealing the winners on our live show on March 1st. That's the Saturday right before the Oscars. So I don't know who I'm going to vote for Best Picture, but I can tell you right now, this is my favorite film.
The reason this
is my favorite film is that this is the music that I grew up with.
Right.
My parents, who, you know, grew up in the 50s, were not rock and rollers.
Right.
My parents were into folk music. They would go to the Hungry Eye in San Francisco and see all these acts like Joan Baez, like Pete Seeger, like the Highwaymen and the Limelighters and the Kingston Trio when they toured. And those, along with musicals, were the albums I grew up listening to. And then going up to summer camps, which people have heard me talk about, I sang Woody Guthrie songs. And I saw, so folk music, it's just real deep in my DNA. And so this kind of a period piece, I just loved it top to bottom. Mm. I really, really did. Not only did I loved it so much that I went, strangely enough, I was never a Dylan guy. I, of course, knew all the big songs, but I went out and got a bunch of Dylan albums and I listened to a bunch of Dylan. And then I went, I'm still kind of obsessively thinking about this. So I bought the book, Dylan Goes Electric, and listened to the book because I was so just taken up with this world and this era. I loved it top to bottom. Like I said, am I saying this is the best picture of the year? I don't know that yet. I literally have not made that decision.
Yeah.
Is it my favorite? So far, this is my favorite movie. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a fascinating film for me because I loved it. And you all know, if you've watched me on the Schmodown or you've heard me talk on this particular podcast, I love biopics. I'm such a fan of biopics. I'm obsessed with them. You know, this year I've decided to really dial into reading again and reading more books. And I bought 10 biographies to start off my year that I want to read. Ranging from Ulysses S. Grant to Theodore Roosevelt to Churchill to any number to Gandhi, just want to dive in and read more of this stuff. So I love biopics, and I just put that Dylan book on my Amazon list here to purchase soon.
It's good
because really great. That's great to know because I love this movie. I absolutely love this movie. I've seen it 3 times now. Having it on the Critics' Choice app has been a godsend. Being able to go back and watch it as many times as I like has been fantastic. I think James Mangold has directed a wonderful film that really captures Bob Dylan and this time. As you said, Steve, I don't have the connection you have to the folk scene in that way, but I grew up loving folk music as a young man and was all into that stuff, Peter, Paul, and Mary, certainly Joan Baez, a little bit of Dylan, not as strongly. Like you, I came to Dylan a little bit later in life. And when I did come to Dylan, I just devoured it, the lyrics and all of that stuff. It was when I was studying English at community college, there trying to kind of get back to getting a degree, that I really got into the lyrics of Bob Dylan and then by extension, his music and his songs. And so to see it so well captured here, and this is an underdog Bob Dylan. This is a Dylan walking into the folk music world who's not known, who's trying to make his name, who's wondering if he fits, if he doesn't fit, where he fits, how he's going to make it. And these two mentors become a huge part of his life. These two women become a massive part of his life. And then we see him grow as an artist into the kind of prickly, judgmental, rebellious, and at times divisive person that we see here. And sometimes that gets lost when you think about Bob Dylan nowadays. You forget that it was once this young man who rolled through the folk music scene, made a name for himself, and almost broke it in half by going electric at that legendary Newport festival. So for me, I thought this film completely captured that, took care with the characters and the people they were portraying, and then brought us to a fantastic finale that was shocking and satisfying at the same time.
I think James Mangold does a great job. And I'll say two things just at the front.
Yeah.
One is that world was totally convincing. Yes. I was completely just like, oh, I'm in, you know, the village in the early 60s. I feel completely like this was real. And that, of course, is a compliment to the costumes, to the production design, makeup and hair and all that stuff. And, of course, James Mangold overseeing it all.
Yeah.
I also think if the music isn't going to be good, you're going to be in deep shit with a movie like this.
Yes.
And top to bottom, everyone is great. And you got to give so much to Chalamet to find a way to find his version of Bob Dylan, because this is one where it's so easy to fall into, you know, doing an Bob Dylan impression, and he doesn't do that. But I was completely convinced by him from the beginning to the end.
Yeah. And that's, as you said, it's not easy to do. And that's what, no surprise that he got nominated. No surprise. A lot of people think he might get that victory at the Oscar ceremony. We'll see if he gets the victory at our ceremony for the Cinephiles Oscars Awards. But yeah, I found him to be so believable and interesting and challenging and magnetic and electric and charming and frustrating as well all throughout the movie. And never for one second did I think this wasn't Bob Dylan. And that speaks volumes to the great performance that Timothée Chalamet did, along with singing the songs, which he really nails. And I don't think recently a lot of actors have really, I don't think Taron really nailed Elton John. I don't think Rami Malek nailed Freddie Mercury. I don't think a lot of these recent actors have fully nailed the characters they were portraying. I think Chalamet goes a step above them all, even though I know Rami won for his performance. I think Chalamet delivers a way better performance encapsulating Dylan that you can't take your eyes off of. But he isn't the only one in this film, Steve. We should talk about this next. I mean, Edward Norton is Pete Seeger. This is one of the most restrained performances I've ever seen from him. Elle Fanning as Sylvie Russo, which is essentially an amalgam of Bob Dylan's former girlfriend here. Monica Barbaro is Joan Baez. She's electric. Boyd Holbrook with the occasional scenes as Johnny Cash was fantastic in the film as well. And I think Scoot McNairy as Woody, a nonverbal performance that carried so much weight. What did you think about the acting? You've already spoken about Chalamet. What about these other actors and the roles they played here in the film?
So this is one of my favorite Ed Norton performances. And it's so interesting because it's so different from you know, all the stuff we've seen from Ed. And I'm a big fan of Ed Norton's. I understand that he can be difficult. I understand that he has extremely strong opinions. But I always like him in movies. I think he's a phenomenal actor. But this one with the restraint, and it's so funny because I know a lot about Pete Seeger. Mm. And I remember reading, there's a book called Dangerously Funny, which is about the Smothers Brothers and about their comedy hour, where Pete Seeger is part of what brought that down, because he had been blacklisted and then was finally put on TV and then sang the song he wasn't supposed to sing because he can't not sing the protest song. Like he can't. And what's so funny about Pete Seeger, and I think they captured it so well, is there's this weird way he's kind of like Mr. Rogers, which is that he really believes what he says he believes.
Yes.
He is a person of the people who believes that if we can all just get together and sing together, we can solve all the world's problems. And that's totally sincere. He's a completely sincere person.
Yeah.
And what's so funny about it is completely sincere people are irritating. And Pete Seeger is irritating. Yeah, you know, it's like, and I think, again, this is not about the performance, but about the writing and the structure, is you have the scene right at the beginning. So he goes to meet Woody Guthrie, and then they're in the car, and some rock and roll music comes on. And Pete Seeger dismisses it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Dylan is like, no, I kind of like this. And you could see, like, right at the beginning,
yeah,
in that moment, you go, oh, I can see the whole journey of this film.
Yes.
Of the difference between these two guys. I think Monica Barbaro as Joan Baez, ooh, again, really hard to pull off. A, you got to have the voice of an angel.
Yeah.
You got to be beautiful. You got to have that restraint that Joan Baez has.
Yeah.
I think it's – and by the way, one thing I find really interesting is that two people that Joan Baez dated, one is Bob Dylan. Another, a decade and a half later, is Steve Jobs, who was a huge Bob Dylan fan. And I just always find that to be like the weirdest thing to put together. And I think – and the other thing that's so great about the casting and everyone you mentioned is they feel like characters from the late 50s, early 60s. They totally are cast – to fill out those roles of the music executive, the manager, all the man, Boyd Holbrook. It's interesting that Magnold has directed Johnny Cash twice.
Yeah, twice. Yes.
You know,
yeah.
And I think he does a great version of it. I think there's a lot of great performances here.
Yeah. It's right. Cause it's different Johnny Cash at a different time when he catches them. I think Holbrook brings an electricity to it that I would love to see in the future one more time. Maybe a full on movie with him would be incredible under Mangold's hand. And I agree with you. I mean, just the performance of Monica Barbaro delivers. And this is an actress that I really enjoyed in Top Gun Maverick. So to see her get a chance to bring Joan Baez to life, who I admittedly am not the biggest knowledgeable person about Joan Baez. I know of her. I've obviously seen her perform. But seeing her come to life through Monica made me go onto YouTube and watch some of her performances and her interviews and whatever. And she's just a phenomenally intelligent, driven, wonderful woman. And when you watch her here in the film, like, she is not someone to be messed around with.
No.
She was already established. So in essence, she was lending some of her fame to Bob to legitimize Bob, just like Pete did in his way as well. So in a way, Bob comes in and becomes everyone's kind of like favorite kid brother and then blossoms into something much more. And so seeing that relationship and the battles they have. My biggest complaint about the movie, because I think Elle Fanning does a wonderful job as well in the film as Bob Dylan's initial girlfriend here, who is based on Suze Rotolo. I think both of them do excellent work throughout the movie in establishing who they are very clearly and cleanly. And in their battles and also sweet moments with Bob Dylan, there's so much to savor and enjoy. My complaint about the film is that I wish they had been in it more, because I so enjoyed their relationships. I wanted to see more from them. I agree with you on Edward Norton, brother, as I said, to tease it, like, one of the most restrained, yet one of the most incredible performances. I would put this up with anything he's done in Crueling Primal Fear as an actor, like watching an actor work through this and like short circuit all his impulses to do the things that you've seen Edward Norton do before in order to really portray who Pete Seeger was. And that inspired me to watch Pete Seeger on YouTube to see how close Edward was. And he nailed it, nailed it. And I agree with you. That scene teases what's coming so that when you see what's coming near the end of the film, you are sitting back in shock at what Pete Seeger is doing there because of the buildup that has been happening here and the way he's portrayed by Edward Norton in the film that I thought was damn good. And again, Scoot, what a great performance, nonverbal performance. I wonder how they pitched this to him, but I think he delivers so much gravitas and empathy in certain moments with his back and forth Dylan that thoroughly worked for me.
John, did you know that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? I mean, it's not just about your birthday. Your body could be a little bit older, could be a little bit younger than what you think. And that's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age. Plus, get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part, it's all done from the comfort of your home. No prescriptions, no lab visits. It's just a simple test sent right to your door.
Yeah, Steve, that's why I was so excited when True Diagnostics said they wanted to come on and sponsor us here on The Cinephiles. You know, you and me both talk about our health, and certainly people listening to us, they're very aware of their health as they get a little bit older, and you want to kind of stop things from coming or be more aware of what might be coming. And True Diagnostics has a thing called True Age Test. And in that True Age Test, you can find out so much about the age of your body, which helps you. So I was very excited when I got my True Age Test recently from True Diagnostics.
And the cool part is this is not guesswork. The True Age Test is based on peer-reviewed research from scientists working at Harvard, Duke, and Yale. I mean, this is real science that you can trust. So think about what it would be like to know exactly how your lifestyle is impacting your body. True Diagnostic makes it easy to get started, offering simple, actionable insights that you can use right away. This is your chance to take control of your health and get the bigger picture. Don't leave it to chance. True Diagnostic helps you understand not just where you're at now, but where you're headed.
All great points, Steve. All right, Cinephiles fans, are you ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at TrueDiagnostic.com by using the code CINEPHILES at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic, TrueDiagnostic.com. Just use the code CINEPHILES to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
I'll tell you something interesting that just came from reading the book,
yes,
which is that, which I didn't understand, and it's not really in the movie, but I think it was interesting enough to bring up here, which is that what I didn't understand in my mind, when I think of folk music,
yeah,
I think of Bob Dylan and other musicians, Joan Baez, and people yeah. doing, particularly the idea of the singer-songwriter doing their own original material in yeah. a way, that's what I think of. That's not what folk music is that Pete Seeger thinks of.
Right.
What Pete Seeger is thinking of is it is the music of the people.
Yeah.
It's not about writing your new material. It's about all of those people that were playing their guitar or, you know, in the small town or on the farm or whatever, playing their banjo, and that there, that music of the people is what's amazing. And that's what he wants to bring out. So what's interesting when you read the book, yes, it is about going electric, but they had a whole bunch of other electric acts. It's not like Dylan. There was always electric acts because right. blues was part of folk music
yes.
in the way that Pete Seeger thought of it because right. it was the music of the people.
Which we and have so, scenes of that in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. Points yeah. yeah. There's a one scene that's fantastic. It's incredible. Such a good scene. Yeah. And so what's interesting is like this idea of the singer-songwriter, of the individual artist. That's really being invented by Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
In this moment, he becomes this model, and it's so interesting watching. They do it in such a beautiful way of mm-hmm. just here's this person who has this unbelievable talent, who is, as we know from the title, somewhat unknowable
yeah.
on some fundamental level, and yet his talent just simply cannot be denied. He's got an odd voice, he's got an odd presentation, and yet he is, when he comes on the scene, it is just an explosion.
Yeah, know? And it's really a rapid ascent. You know, oh, yeah. I would almost compare this to the Beatles. Once the Beatles Absolutely. Got known, their ascent was like a shooting star. And the same thing here with Dylan, right? Comes in 1961 at the beginning of the film. Nobody knows him, at least the way the film is portraying it. He walks in on Woody and Pete there and impresses them. And that begins this relationship with Pete and Woody. And then where he goes step by step, he's a little frustrated. He's building. Joan is noticing him more and he's starting to write. And then the stuff with him and Sylvie are there's problems happening because she's frustrated that he's aloof and he's distant. And he's coming up with these amazing songs and writing these amazing lyrics and then takes advantage of a gap in time in their relationship to all of a sudden just become this massive shooting star because of the way he's writing this protest music. And people take more than a few moments to comment how a man this young can write the lyrics that he's writing. There's a couple of shots in the studio. Like, who wrote this? He did. What? And so there is this surprise, almost like Shakespeare. How does a guy write like this who comes from this upbringing? How is he this mature? How is he writing something that's this amazing from such a young age? What is it about this guy that is coming through in this way? And it causes jealousy. It causes division. It causes frustration from other people. And then he becomes almost in a way angered by the chains that he once wanted to be chained to. He now becomes angry about the chains that are around him because he wants this freedom to be who he wants to be. And if you know the history of Dylan, he goes on numerous journeys. He even has a religious phase where he's changing throughout. Same thing with Van Morrison. They go through these periods where they legitimately believe that this is now the path they need to walk as artists. So in a lot of ways, Dylan is a pure artist, and watching this film is a great encapsulation of seeing the patterns that we're going to see for decades afterwards with Dylan through this movie.
I think your Beatles comparison is really important because there's a sense, you know, if you hear the Beatles in 1963, 64, when they come to the US, they are a pop, fun, upbeat, you know, British invasion band.
Right.
And there, I am sure, because, you know, this is how these industries work, is like, oh, you do that. And I'm sure there are many people who's like, well, do the next album that sounds like I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Right.
But that's not who the Beatles are. That's not the Beatles are saying that. And I know I've mentioned this many times on the show, but one of my favorite books is Malcolm Gladwell's Miracle and Wonder about Paul Simon, which is really has to be listened to as an audiobook because it's interviews with Paul Simon and they're playing the music. And right at the beginning, when Paul Simon writes Sound of Silence, Gladwell asks him, so did you think of yourself as a folk musician?
Yeah.
And Paul Simon said, no, I never thought of myself as, even though you can't get more folk music than Simon and Garfunkel in that era. But that's not what Paul Simon never thought that. And Bob Dylan never thought that.
Yeah.
And that's what you see in that very first scene with Pete Seeger in the car is that he did a bunch of folk music. And then everybody goes, well, you're a folk. You are not just a folk musician. You are the folk musician.
Yes.
You have to be, you know, it's, you know, dance monkey boy. You have to do what we're asking you to do and keep doing it the way we wanted to do it. And you can watch, and Chalamet plays it so well. And again, you know, we're not going to spoil most of these movies, but this is history, so I feel a little bit better about.
Yeah,
you can watch Chalamet in his reactions when people are trying to tell him what to be.
Yeah,
and that he, as Bob Dylan, is going, no, that's not who. And the more they try to tell him who to be, the more he gets that twinkle in his eye that says, "I'm not going to be who you want me to be. I'm going to be me." You know.
Well, this is why one of the reasons why he transcends so much in pop culture, because he is at his heart a rebel. It is rebellious to call out the hateful things that are happening in the world. It is rebellious to push back on the way things have been done before. You need to get in line. Even within a protest movement, there is this thing of like, well, you need to follow the rules, right? And so you see all of that, and he always tries to break through. And even in his musical stylings, he is rebellious in how he approaches his music. So all of that being laid so well at the feet of this film. What about the writing in the film here, Steve? Did you enjoy that as well? I mean, I think that's also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. Yes, James Mangold and Jay Cox, as I said, off that novel that you recently read here by Elijah Wald. So what did you think about some of the writing, the interactions, the back and forth that go on throughout the movie here between these characters?
Man, I have so much admiration for people that can adapt a true story in a complicated one in this kind of way. It's so hard. Because of course, like I said, I listened to the book after, and there's so many details in the book that I found totally fascinating, and they had to say, that's not going to be in the movie. You know, like they had to really frame it. It's so much about what you take out. That's the first step of like trying to figure out how to write this thing. People think of writing as like you're writing dialogue, which of course you're going to do, but that's not the hardest part of what they did. They had to figure out what to take out, how to frame the story, and how to make it thematically all of a piece. And I think the title, A Complete Unknown, and what we've been talking about, of trying to understand who this person, Bob Dylan, is, and how Bob Dylan is trying to say who he is really, really fascinating. And it's funny, you mentioned the scene, the blues scene, which I'm assuming you is like the sort of public access TV show scene.
Oh, such a great scene.
That scene is a perfect example of a scene that actually doesn't have to be in the movie. It doesn't advance the story in the sense of his relationship with Joan Baez or whether or not he's going to go electric or all those things. It advances it maybe a little bit with Pete Seeger, but in some ways it sort of pushes against what you're trying to do with Pete Seeger. And yet that scene is in the heart of the film.
Yeah.
And so deciding that we want to have it and who that character of that blues musician is and how that all works is just fantastic.
Yeah, agreed. And you know, I've already spoken about the way these journeys go in the movie with these real life characters and their interactions and their relationships. and all the changes that occur in them. I think those are all really well written and phenomenally laid out so that you are really attached to these relationships and invested into what's going on. But I also think the moments of comedy are like Dan Fogler as Albert Grossman. Dan is one of my favorite actors to watch in almost anything. You can leave Josh Gad out with the trash. I will take Dan Fogler any day of the week to do everything Josh Gad does. I would love him. He was the best part of Fantastic Beasts. And so whenever he gets a chance to do, I even loved his film Balls of Fury, for God's sakes, the ping pong ball movie. But whenever he gets to do what he's great at, which is playing these really interesting character actors and put a little flair to them, he is such a joy to watch. And I think it's necessary because the film is so serious in certain moments. You need to have a little bit of comedy throughout, and to write that into where it should be is so smart and so tough to do. And I don't know if that's in the novel in the book portrayed in that way. But what Dan brings to the character of Albert Grossman, I think, is essential for the film working and keeping you interested in what's happening.
Totally, totally agree. And I think he does a fantastic job. And I think I keep going back to the world of the village in the early 60s. Yeah. And I just kind of go, there are certain times in history, like you go, you know, summer, you go 6 years later, Summer of Love in San Francisco. You go, you know, to the Gilded Age. Like we could go through Midnight in Paris to some of those eras, you know, the era with Hemingway and all that crowd, I'll just say, in Paris at those times. There are these moments where art catches fire.
Yeah.
And I am so jealous, I guess, of just like going like, oh, can you imagine being there where everybody's trying things?
Yeah.
People are failing all the time. People are making mistakes. People are staying up late, smoking cigarettes and drinking and playing their guitars. And I just love having been grown up as an artist and been around, I love that world. And so I was so drawn to just wanting to be there.
Yeah. It's so funny because before I'd seen the movie, like a couple of weeks before, I had watched Inside Llewyn Davis for the first time in a long time, because it's one of those Coen Brothers films that I'm not the biggest fan of. And by the way, we're about to jump into our season of Coen Brothers coming up soon. It's not one of the films that stands out to me as one of the, like, but I watched it again because I was like, I want to see what I'm missing about this movie that everyone seems to love so much. Because I think it was named the best film of the last 20 years or 10 years or whatever. And I watched it and I was like, yeah, I still feel the same way about this movie that I did. But the way it captures that scene and that time, it has a much more darker approach because of where we're going with his character. So to juxtapose it to what we see here, which is this time of like excitement and creativity and being challenged and the competition of it all, I think is great. I mean, there's a scene in the movie where it's like, what, you wrote that song originally? Like Dylan, like, oh yeah, we share music. It's okay. He'll respect it. You know, this idea of sharing songs with each other, even within this creatively competitive atmosphere, is a fascinating element throughout. And I think the way that's written and constructed and the back and forth that happened with all of that is really another part of the film that I thoroughly enjoy.
Well, that's one of the things that I learned from reading the book is this idea of the folk music world at that time was, of course, everyone singing everyone else's songs because that's what folk music is.
Right.
Folk music is it isn't the artist comes and gives a performance for you to listen to. Yeah. It's we're all going to sing together. It's we're all sharing in this kind of an experience. I wonder how people who know nothing about that music and know nothing about that era would experience it. But for me, who grew up with a lot of this stuff, it was just a joy.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. Any final words about the music or the sound or anything else? Because, I mean, Timothée Chalamet, according to reports, recorded 40 songs, 40 Bob Dylan songs in preparation for the movie. So I think for him, helping him as a character to develop, or as an actor rather, to develop the Bob Dylan character for the film. But I think also because the soundtrack has a lot of his interpretations of Bob Dylan's music and songs. So what did you think about the sound, which was also one of the nominated categories for the Academy Awards for this movie?
So one thing on Chalamet first, which is that everyone's talking about his singing, which they should, but I haven't heard anyone talking about his guitar playing.
Ah, great points. And he did it live on SNL two songs. Yeah.
I mean, that's not easy, you know? And it's funny because I never really thought, because like I said, I never was a Dylan guy of like, oh, that he's actually a great guitar player. He's a great musician.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought so much about that. And then watching Chalamet, and obviously I'm not a guitar player, and I'm sure maybe it didn't sound as good on the set. And some real guitar player would say that he's not that good, but they really convinced me that he was playing it. And I think in terms of sound design, this is hard.
Yeah.
Because you need to get exactly the sweet spot. We've all seen things where it's so obviously lip sync to a pre-recorded thing that sounds like it was made in the studio. And we can't have that because every single microphone in every single location, whether he's in the church or the tiny club or the music studio or the Newport Folk Festival, they all have to sound like they're in that space.
Yeah.
And that's a real challenge both in how you mic the material, how you mix the material, and they did a fabulous job. So I think in terms of sound, they did a great, great job.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And I hope I've said enough about James Mangold, but I love the direction in this movie. You know, it can be easy to overlook his direction because it's such a, it's just a chronicle of this man's life. But the way he moves us, as you just mentioned, into all these different areas to hear what the sound sounds like, but also to move us in there to see what these interactions are between these actors playing these real life roles, and the way he frames it and shoots it, and the overall look of it and the energy and the vibe. I think it transports us so effectively back to this time to experience it almost like for the first time, which I think speaks volumes about why he got the nomination for Best Director.
Agreed.
All right, well, there you go. That's our breakdown of A Complete Unknown, the second in our Oscar series here that we're profiling. And of course, you might be listening to it out of order, but this is the order that we're deciding to go in. This is our second one, and I thought this was a very fun conversation. Steve, what do we have to tell them as we wrap up here?
Well, the biggest thing is that the Cinephiles Awards is coming on March 1st. And so if you want to vote in it, all you have to do is join the free tier at patreon.com/thecinephiles. Of course, you're welcome to join one of the paid tiers where you could get ad-free versions of the show or access to our Cinephiles shorts or even join our advisory board that helped us figure out how we were going to do all of this. that's really important. I think we are going to put all of the Best Picture nominations up on cinephiles.net where you can buy or stream them there if you haven't seen them. If you do watch them, we'd love to hear your comments. You can do that on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles, Cine_files on Twitter, or The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. And if you want to subscribe to the podcast, if you haven't already, well, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and a whole bunch of other podcast apps are available. And if you feel like leaving us a beautiful, glowing 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, it would be very, very appreciated. And if you want to reach me, it's SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
And you can reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays. See all the stuff we got going on there. And don't forget our YouTube channel, the Cinephiles YouTube channel. Hunt that out to see all the stuff that we do there. Once a month, we do a live show there. You can come hang out with us and have some fun with us live. Thanks so much for listening to this, and we'll talk to you next time with another brand new movie that has been nominated for Best Picture here in our Oscar series on The Cinephiles. Take care until then.